This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Vince Flynn, The Survivor, a Mitch Rapp novel by Kyle Mills. Read by George Goodell.
To Vince Flynn, a man who touched so many lives. Prelude, Istanbul, Turkey. Scott Coleman turned away from the color monitor and glanced right. The panel van seemed almost like a toy by American standards, barely large enough to fit him and his surveillance gear in the back. Even tighter was the front seat, where Joe Maslick's 220-pound frame was wedged behind the wheel. Raindrops were collecting on the windshield, blurring ancient row houses and a street narrow enough that passing required having two wheels on the sidewalk. After days on the move in a city where good driving etiquette meant clipping fewer than three people a week, they'd resigned themselves to the impossibility of staying with a pedestrian target. Since then, they'd been bouncing from illegal parking space to illegal parking space, trying to maximize their surveillance camera's signal strength. No small feat in a city constructed almost entirely of stone.
"How you doing up there, Joe?"
"Fine." It was a lie, of course, but it was the expected lie. In fact, the former Delta soldier had recently been shot in a Kabul ambush that had left a hell of a lot of Afghan cops dead, put Mitch Rapp way too close to an explosion of his own making, and forced an agonizing alliance with Louis Gould, the assassin who had killed Rapp's family. Maslick should have been at home, rehabbing his shoulder, but he'd insisted on being included on this op. Bringing him along had been a tough call. The doctors were concerned about permanent nerve damage, but sometimes it was better to get back in the saddle as soon as possible, before doubt could creep in.
"Glad to hear you're having such a good time. Right now our feed looks solid, moving north on a pretty open street. We should be able to stay here for a little while, but be ready to move."
"Right." Maslick's one-word answers had nothing to do with what must have been the considerable pain in his arm. He'd always resisted stringing more than two or three together unless it was absolutely necessary. Coleman turned his attention back to the screen secured to the side of the van. The image rocked wildly as the purse the camera was hidden in swung from its owner's hand. Sky, a feral cat lounging on a dumpster, thick ankles overflowing a pair of sensible shoes. The legs and hush puppies belonged to Bibi Kincaid, a plump, gray-haired woman who was the most unlikely employee of his company, SEAL, Demolition, and Salvage. She'd spent her adult life as an FBI surveillance expert based on two considerable natural gifts. Her bland features, formless figure, and slightly bowed shuffle made her as anonymous as a fire hydrant. But more important, she had a photographic memory. It was a label that was often thrown around to describe people who didn't forget much, but Bibi was the rare real thing. In fact, it was her flawless memory that had gotten her eased into early retirement by the FBI psychologists. The older she got, the more she struggled to differentiate between things that had happened yesterday and things that had happened years, even decades, ago. To her, the memories were all equally vivid. She was perhaps not bureau material anymore, but Mitch Rapp had been on the phone to her before she'd finished cleaning out her desk. Coleman had to admit that he'd been a little irritated when a woman who reminded him of his mother showed up at his company's nondescript door to thank him not only for the job, but for the generous mental health benefits. As usual, though, Rapp had been right. Bibi was worth her considerable weight in gold. Coleman glanced at a second screen that displayed a satellite image of Istanbul with a single blue dot representing Bibi's position. It suddenly took a hard left and started down a set of stairs toward the waterfront.
"Okay, Joe, she's turned east and we're going to lose her. Can we close in?"
"Old lady gets around," Maslick said, grudging respect audible beneath his irritation at having to wade back into city traffic. Coleman smiled as they pulled away from the curb. His men were all former special forces, primarily SEALs, Delta, and Recon Marines. With the right set of support hose, though, it was possible that Beebe could run them all into the ground. He wedged a foot against his state-of-the-art electronics to keep them from shifting as the van struggled up a rain-slickened hill. On the main monitor, Beebe's camera swept briefly across the man they were following. He was a much to look at, 5'8", a slight Asian tilt to his features, and a mediocre suit pulled close against the rain. In reality, though, Vasily Zhutov was the CIA's highest-placed mole in the Russian Foreign Intelligence Service. Codenamed Sitting Bull, he was among the agency's most clandestine and hard-won assets. The problem was that no one was sure if his identity was still a secret. Worse, it wasn't just his cover that had potentially been blown. It was the cover of virtually every CIA asset recruited in the last quarter century. Teams like Coleman's had been deployed across the globe, spread way too thin to do any more than make educated guesses as to who might be targeted. And it was all because of one man, the late Joseph Rick Rickman. Rickman had been stationed in Jalalabad for the last 8 years and had pretty much run the CIA's side of the war in Afghanistan. Word was that he had an IQ just north of 200, and based on Coleman's interactions with the man, he had no reason to dispute that figure. The better part of $1 billion had flowed through Rickman's hands over the years, funding weapons purchases, bribes to local politicians, and God knew what else. Rick had a relationship with virtually every player in the country, and had an uncanny ability to track the complex forces tearing the region apart. If asked about the economic effect of the heroin trade on the insurgency, he could lecture like a Harvard PhD. Conversely, asked about some minor family dispute between two mountain villages no one had ever heard of, he'd speak with equal authority. The only person at the agency who could even hope to keep up with what was going on in that man's head was Irene Kennedy, and she had too many other things on her plate to try. Unfortunately, the house of cards Rickman had built all came crashing down the previous month when he completely lost his mind. Whether it was the pressure of the job, family problems, or just the chaos and hopelessness of Afghanistan, no one knew. What they did know, though, was that Rickman had hatched a plot with Akhtar Durrani, the deputy general of Pakistan's ISI, to betray the CIA and the people Rickman had fought with for his entire career. Rickman had killed his bodyguards and faked his own kidnapping, going so far as to release a gut-wrenching video of himself being tortured by two men posing as Muslim extremists. It had been like setting off a bomb in the U.S. intelligence community. With his incredible intellect and decades of CIA ops under his belt, there was no way for anyone to know what information he was privy to and how much of it he'd give up when the hot pokers came out. Panic ensued, with countless undercover assets requesting extraction, demanding asylum at U.S. embassies, and generally drawing a lot of unwanted attention to America's spy network. During his faked interrogation, Rickman had blurted out a number of names, but one in particular had generated a wave of dread in Langley. Sitting Bull. Russia hadn't been Rick's theater of operation, and the identity of the man was one of the CIA's most closely held secrets. Was it a red herring? Nothing more than a couple of meaningless words he'd overheard and socked away in that magnificent brain of his? Or had he actually gotten hold of enough information to compromise the Russian? Zhutov turned left into an alley, and Beebe hung back. Istanbul's streets were generally packed with people this time of afternoon, but they were moving into a neighborhood made up of dilapidated, unoccupied houses. Based on the shaky camera feed, there were only a couple of people on the street. "Joe," Coleman said, "are you watching the map? He's cutting north. Can we get ahead of him?" "Maybe. Lots of traffic," Maslick muttered, rerouting onto the sidewalk to get around a delivery truck. "Beebe, we're coming around," Coleman said into a microphone clipped to his collar. "Give that alley a miss and take the next one. They end up on the same square."
"Roger that."
The money was good, but Coleman was starting to wonder how much longer he could stand being stuck on a surveillance detail that was looking more and more like a waste of time. Both Rickman and Durrani were dead, which should have been the end of it. On the other hand, it didn't pay to underestimate Rickman's ability to plan 15 steps ahead. Everyone at the agency believed that there was more classified information floating around than was on the torture video Rickman had posted to the Internet. Kennedy had gone one step further, though. She was concerned that Ricklin might have figured out a way to keep his vendetta against the agency moving forward from beyond the grave. It seemed a little paranoid to Coleman, but then he was just a soldier. Better to leave the strategizing to Kennedy and Rapp. They were good at it.
"Scott," Beebe said over the radio, "are you getting this?"
The swinging image that Coleman had become so accustomed to stabilized as she aimed the purse-mounted camera toward a man wearing a leather jacket and jeans. He was lighting a cigarette and looked pretty much like the other million or so Turks his age living in the city.
"I've seen him before," Beebe said, 2 days ago, by the trolley up on the shopping street. He came out of a store and followed the subject for 6½ blocks before turning off."
Coleman cursed under his breath as the man started casually down the alley the Russian had disappeared into. Normally this was when he'd ask if she was certain, but there was no point. As far as anyone could tell, Beebe had never made a mistake with regard to a face.
"What do you think, Beebe? Any chance it could be a coincidence?"
1,000,000 to 1.
"Okay, continue to the next alley and let's see if this guy trades off to someone else you recognize."
"On it," she said.
Coleman reached for a secure satellite phone, feeling a vague sense of foreboding. Rapp was not going to be happy. Chapter 1 The Farm. Near Harper's Ferry, West Virginia, USA. The safe house was beginning to take on the feeling of a prison for Kennedy. She'd sat through too many of these post-operation debriefings to begin to count. But over her 30-plus-year career at the CIA, it was safe to say the numbers were in the triple digits. The pungent smell of cigarettes, too much coffee, not enough sleep, and too few workouts combined to throw off an all-too-familiar funk. For her part, she got to leave. Had to, really. As director of the CIA, she couldn't simply vanish for a week straight. She spent her days locked almost entirely behind the soundproof door of her seventh-floor office at Langley, trying to sort out the mess that had come to be known as the Rickman Affair. And even that had raised some eyebrows. The damage was bad, as it always was, with this type of thing. But the question was, how bad? Kennedy didn't fault Rapp for killing her Near East Black Ops chief. Getting him out of Pakistan would have proved problematic, especially after that duplicitous bastard, Lieutenant General Durrani, was killed. Had Rapp managed to keep Rickman alive, they would have been left with a man whose twisted intellect was capable of sowing so many seeds of disinformation and dissent that the CIA would have been eating itself from the inside out by the time he was done. No, they were all better off with Rickman out of the picture. As Hurley was fond of saying, dead men tell no lies. They also offered no information, which was what Kennedy had been trying to assess during her days locked behind her door. Rapp had recovered a laptop as well as some hard drives from General Durrani's house. They were Rickman's, and her best people were poring over the encrypted CIA files, trying to determine what assets, operatives, and agents may have been compromised. One operation, due to its current sensitivity, had her particularly worried, and there were already some signs that things might be going off the tracks, which in this particular case was a very appropriate metaphor.
"What are we going to do with them?"
Kennedy slowly closed the red file on the kitchen table, removed her brown glasses, and rubbed her tired eyes. Mike Nash set a fresh cup of tea in front of her and took a seat.
"Thank you."
After a moment, she added, "I'm not sure what we're going to do with him. I've left it up to those two for now." Nash looked out the sliding glass door where night was falling on Mitch Rapp and Stan Hurley. Kennedy had forced him to go outside to smoke. Nash couldn't tell for sure, but they probably were also drinking bourbon. "I don't mean Gould. I mean I care about what we do with him, but for the moment, I'm more worried about what we're going to do with Mitch." Kennedy was growing tired of this. She talked to their resident shrink about the tension between Nash and Rapp, and for the most part they were on the same page. Rapp was Nash's senior by a few years, and through some pretty impressive maneuvering, Rapp had been able to end Nash's covert career. The how and why were a bit complicated, but in the end, it was plainly a noble gesture. Nash had a wife and 4 kids, and Rapp didn't want to see all that thrown away on a dangerous life that someone else could handle. Nash, for his part, felt betrayed by Rapp. Their closeness was a natural casualty as Rapp began to share fewer and fewer operational details with his friend,
who now spent his time at Langley and on Capitol Hill.
"I know you're worried," Kennedy said, "but you have to stop trying to control him. Trust me, I've spent 20 years trying, and the best I can do is nudge him in a general direction."
Nash frowned. "He's going to end up just like Stan, a bitter, lonely old man who's dying of lung cancer. Look at Stan. Even now he can't put those damn things down."
"Don't judge, Mike," Kennedy said with a weary tone. "He's been through a lot. How he chooses to go out is no one's business but his own."
"But Mitch is as plain as day. That's the road he's on."
Kennedy thought about it for a long moment, taking a sip of tea. "We're not all made for white picket fences and 9-to-5 jobs. He most certainly isn't."
"No, but each time he goes out, the odds are stacked against him."
"I used to think so," Kennedy smiled. "And then I came to a very simple conclusion."
"What's that?"
"He's a survivor."
Chapter 2.
Above Istanbul, Turkey.
The CIA's Gulfstream G550 started a lazy banking maneuver, and Mitch Rapp peered out the window. The Bosphorus was directly below, streaked with boat wakes and divided by a bridge linking Asia to Europe. It was a familiar view, the densely packed buildings, the traffic-choked streets, and the ancient mosques representing a religion that had been subverted by evil men. A light fog condensed around the plane, obscuring his line of sight. He leaned back in his seat, closing his eyes and letting himself drift back to the first time he'd been there. To his first kill, so many years ago. The man's name had been Sharif. By outward appearance, he'd been a successful and widely respected real estate investor. In fact, his extensive property portfolio was nothing more than a way to launder the hundreds of millions of dollars he made selling arms to anyone willing to meet his price. Strangely, the particulars of the assassination remained more vivid in Rapp's mind than all the others that had followed. He could still smell the tiny apartment that had been rented for him through a maze of CIA shell corporations. He could recall how the Beretta 92F he'd favored at the time felt heavier and colder in his hand than it had during training. The memory of the operational details brought a barely perceptible and slightly embarrassed smile to his face. He'd completely discarded Stan Hurley's plan, partially out of youthful arrogance and partly to stick his middle finger in the man's face. His pursuit of the target into a park that he had only superficial knowledge of seemed hopelessly amateurish to him now, and his use of multiple rounds, when a single properly placed one would have sufficed, was something Hurley still wrote him about when he'd had too much to drink. Well deserved, unfortunately. At the young age of 24, Rapp had been one of the most highly trained and talented assassins on the planet. 2 decades later, though, he could see how inexperienced and overconfident he'd been. No wonder he'd had the old cuss pulling his hair out. Normally, planes put Rapp to sleep. He preferred the roar of a C-130, but what the Gulfstream lacked in white noise, it made up for with its plush leather seating. On this occasion, though, he'd been awake for the entire trip from the United States. Too much on his mind. At the forefront was Stan Hurley, a man he'd once despised and who had undoubtedly wanted to quietly do away with the Orion team's newest recruit after the Sharif job. Rapp had never asked, but he could imagine the knockdown drag-out Hurley and Kennedy had over that. The old man screaming that Rapp was already out of control and Kennedy calmly extolling their young recruit's potential. It would have been interesting if she'd lost that particular argument. Who would have come out on top, him or Hurley? It was a question that would never be answered. His old friend would be gone soon. Rapp could smell death a mile away, and Hurley stunk of it, just like everyone did eventually. Just like he would one day. Rapp opened his eyes, but didn't bother looking out the window again. Dwelling on Hurley's cancer was a waste of time. It was beyond his control, and he had bigger fires to put out. Scott Coleman's update 2 hours ago suggested that the Russian surveillance on Sitting Bull was getting more intense. As problems went, that was only the tip of the iceberg. What worried him was why the man was suddenly being tailed. Certainly not solely because of the brief mention of a code name on the Rickman video.
Russia's internal security agency, the FSB, would have no way to connect it to Vasily Zhutov. No, the only answer was that Rickman had leaked additional classified information before Rapp had put a bullet in his head. But how much more? The hum of the landing gear lowering filled the cabin. Rapp cleared his mind of the 1,000 disaster scenarios fighting for his attention and focused on the problem at hand. The FSB had undoubtedly been following Zhutov to see if he would lead them to anyone interesting. But now Coleman's team was seeing activity that suggested the Russians were setting up for a rendition. The question was what to do about it. Zhutov didn't know anything particularly useful about the CIA's network, and his cover appeared to have already been blown. That made sitting back and letting the FSB snatch him the option that most of the desk jockeys at Langley would go for. Just another casualty in a game they'd been playing with the Russians for nearly 3/4 of a century. In Rapp's mind, and to a slightly lesser degree in Kennedy's, that was an unacceptable sacrifice. Sitting Bull had put himself in harm's way to help the CIA contain Russia's unpredictable and often self-destructive impulses. Rapp had worked with many moles over the years, traitors who betrayed their homelands for money or sex or revenge. They could be useful but were never to be trusted or regarded with anything but contempt. Zhutov was different. He was a patriot who loved his country and believed in its potential to be a positive force in the world. He'd made it clear from the beginning that he would never give up military secrets, and he refused any kind of compensation. Rapp admired him, and there was no way he was going to leave the man twisting in the wind. How many more Sitting Bulls were out there? All the assets Rickman had given up in his phony torture video were accounted for in one way or another, either vanished, dead, squirreled away in a U.S. embassy or covered by a team like Coleman's. What else had Rick known? Who else had he given up before Rapp had killed him? The rain started as they touched down on the private airport's only runway. Rapp walked forward as they taxied, grabbing a duffel from the closet and waiting for the plane to roll to a stop next to a parking lot scattered with cars. The cockpit door remained closed, as was his preference, so he opened the hatch himself and jumped down. A quick scan of the area turned up no movement. The cars all appeared to be empty, and, as promised, no one from the airport was there to greet him. He turned up the collar of his leather jacket to obscure his face, not only from anyone looking down from the tower, but also from his own pilots. The weathered Ford was right where Coleman said it would be, isolated on the east corner of the lot. Rapp tossed his bag in the back and slid behind the wheel. The keys were in the ignition, and a well-used passport identifying him as Mitch Cruz was in the glove box with all the proper entry stamps. He started the engine and pulled out onto the road, staying well within the speed limit as he dialed his phone. It was picked up on the first ring.
"How's the car?" Scott Coleman said.
"Fine. What's the situation? Are our competitors looking to make a move?" The phone was encrypted, but neither of them trusted the technology. In light of the NSA's obsession with vacuuming up every cell signal on the planet, it was best to keep the conversation in line with his cover as a sales executive.
"An hour ago I would have said the situation wasn't pressing. Now, though, things are starting to look more urgent. I'm glad you're here to help close the deal."
Rapp managed to cover the 15 miles to the center of town relatively quickly. Coleman had sent his coordinates to Rapp's phone, and the turn-by-turn instructions were being fed to an earpiece camouflaged by the intersection of his beard and shaggy hair. Parking tended to be opportunistic in Istanbul, so he pulled in behind some disused scaffolding and stepped out into the cool drizzle. The sidewalk was typically crowded with pedestrians, but no one gave him a second glance as he lit a cigarette and started up a side street. The leather jacket and dark jeans were right down the center of Istanbul fashion. Combined with his black hair and dark complexion, he became just another local hurrying to get out of the rain. The clouds were too thick to get a precise bead on the sun, but Rapp guessed it had sunk below the horizon about 5 minutes ago. Headlights were coming on around him, glaring off wet stone, and prompting him to pick up his pace. This is when it would happen. The short period of disorientation when the primitive part of the human mind adjusted from day to night. The foot traffic thinned as he entered an area lined with closed stores devoted to electronics and construction materials.
Sitting Bull would certainly be aware of the Rickman video, but he didn't know his own code name and would have no reason to believe that a man working in Jalalabad would have any knowledge of his existence. Because of that, he was still comfortable routing through this relatively quiet part of Istanbul to get home from his job. Sharif had been cursed with a similarly careless habit of walking his dog in the same park at the same time every morning. And look what happened to him. The mechanical voice was still giving him directions through his earpiece. Another 3 minutes and he spotted the hazy but unmistakable outline of Joe Maslick crammed behind the wheel of a white panel van. Rapp slowed and casually dialed Coleman, looking around as though he were lost. "Have you arrived?" Coleman said by way of greeting. "The meeting is about to start." 30 seconds out. "Want to come in through the back?" Rapp disconnected the call and skirted around the rear of the van, opening the door and slipping into the cramped space. Maslick didn't look back, instead continuing to watch the street through the rain-soaked windshield. Coleman pulled his earphones partially off and pointed toward a shaky image on one of the monitors. "Maybe he's still following Zhutov. Based on what we've seen over the last few days, he'll cross another 2 streets and then go diagonal into a small square. There's a van parked at the north end with 2 men in the front seats. No way to know if anyone's in the back. They've been there for 30 minutes, which is about the variation in Zhutov's schedule depending on if he stops for coffee. Luckily he did today." Rapp nodded. "Tie me into BB." Coleman flipped a switch on the console in front of him and held out the microphone that had been clipped to his collar. The heavily encrypted radio signal didn't travel very far, so Rapp felt comfortable being more direct than he would be on the phone. "BB, slow down when you start to approach the square. I don't want you anywhere near this when it goes down."
"Thanks, Mitch."
The relief in her voice was obvious even over the static. "I'll keep eyes on the subject as long as possible and let you know if anything changes." Rapp handed the microphone back to Coleman and went forward, slipping into the passenger seat.
"All right, Joe, let's roll."
Chapter 3 Islamabad, Pakistan. Dr. Irene Kennedy scrolled through an email on the tablet in her lap, skimming over the details of the Istanbul situation. Sitting Bull's life or death, once one of the CIA's top priorities, was now largely irrelevant. What mattered was that his situation was more evidence that her worst-case scenario was playing out. More and more it seemed to be the way the world worked. What could go wrong inevitably did. Horribly, catastrophically wrong. She shut down the tablet and set it on the seat next to her, staring straight ahead at her own hazy reflection. The limousine's bulletproof glass was heavily tinted, cutting her off from the driver and turning the sunny streets of Islamabad to a dim blur. She knew that there were 2 cars in front and no fewer than 3 behind, all filled with well-armed and well-trained men. The streets had been partially cleared for her motorcade, and a Bell AH-1 Cobra attack helicopter was flying close enough overhead that the thump of the rotors vibrated the vehicle around her. The modern state of Pakistan had been established in 1947, carved from the Muslim regions of British India. In the decades since, it had become the 6th most populous nation in the world, with more than 180 million citizens. But while India had worked to modernize and democratize, its neighbor had toiled for much of its history under the rule of dictators and religious extremists. Now the massive country was on the verge of being a failed state. Powerful fundamentalist currents were undermining the government, countless terrorist organizations had moved in, and control of the north had been almost completely lost. With the economy in shambles, terrorists growing increasingly violent, and paranoia about India reaching a fevered pitch, it was hard to blame the Pakistani people for seeking order and stability from any organizations willing to peddle such hollow promises. Unfortunately, those organizations were the army and the Pakistani intelligence apparatus. Both had grown in influence to the point that it was nearly impossible for the civilian government, and indeed the United States, to keep them in check. The chaos in Pakistan was becoming an impossible situation, a looming disaster that Kennedy no longer believed could be averted. Normally, the circumstances would cause her to push Washington toward a policy of containment. For a number of reasons, that was impossible in the case of Pakistan. movement of American men and materiel through the territory was critical to the war on terror. The country had one of the largest and most poorly controlled armies in the world. But both those issues paled when compared to the fact that the Pakistani government possessed more than 100 nuclear warheads. In many ways, it was a textbook example of the unintended consequences of America's foreign policy. The United States had funneled billions of dollars into the country to fight the Soviets during their invasion of Afghanistan, but in its anti-communist fervor, it hadn't paid attention when much of that money was diverted to Pakistan's WMD program. It was a self-destructive behavior that persisted to this day. America continued to pump money into the country that had created and still quietly supported the Taliban, a country that had sold nuclear technology to Libya, Iran, and North Korea, a country that had hidden Osama bin Laden and now hosted the most dangerous terrorist organizations in the world. The simple truth was that the increasingly dysfunctional men and women in Washington weren't interested in making the difficult choices necessary to win the war against extremism. Pakistan would continue to demand U.S. dollars under the auspices of keeping its nuclear arsenal secure, and the American politicians would continue to blindly hand it over, hoping that it would be enough to keep the lid on the pot long enough to get them through the next election cycle. But was it enough? The danger posed by Pakistan's nuclear program now came from every angle. An accident that India could mistake for an attack, one of the many local terrorist organizations acquiring a warhead, or even a coup that put the entire arsenal in the hands of a fundamentalist government. And at the center of it all was the organization headquartered behind the nondescript gate her motorcade was approaching, Pakistan's Inter-Services Intelligence, or ISI. Her driver didn't slow as they headed for a group of men with dogs and low-mirrored carts meant to check for explosives. Instead of being alarmed by the vehicles barreling toward them, they moved back and offered a sharp salute as Kennedy passed. Undoubtedly, this would be portrayed as a courtesy, an acknowledgement that an American of her stature was above normal procedures. In actuality, it was an admission that slowing could make her vehicle vulnerable to a rocket attack. Once inside the walls, Kennedy rolled down her window and looked out over the manicured lawns, fountains, and carefully maintained adobe buildings. It always struck her that the facility looked more like a university campus than the headquarters of one of the most dangerous and secretive intelligence agencies the world had ever known. Maybe someday one of her successors would come here to find it inhabited by young people with backpacks full of textbooks. She hoped so, but right now that idyllic world seemed 1,000 years away. Her lead cars broke off and the limousine pulled up in front of a large, modern building with a lone man standing in front of it. He hurried to open her door, nodding respectfully as she stepped out. "Dr. Kennedy, welcome. I'm General Taj's assistant, Kabir Gadai." He held out a hand and she took it. His grip had a practiced feel to it, as did the warmth of his smile. According to his CIA file, Gadai was an extremely well-educated moderate Muslim who had just celebrated his 34th birthday. A top college cricket player, he'd spent 5 years in the military after graduation, 2 with the Special Forces. To top it off, his wife was stunning, and his children earned perfect marks, an overachiever in every sense of the word. With the exception of his still solid physique, Gadai's military background was no longer evident. His suit looked like Brooks Brothers, his stylishly cut hair was just a bit over the ear, and his admittedly handsome face was devoid of the mustache favored by many of his colleagues. "If you could please follow me," he said, leading her into a massive, circular lobby with a single security guard who seemed unwilling to even look in their direction. Gadai's voice echoed slightly as he spoke about the building's architecture, the founding of the ISI by a British Army officer in the late 1940s, and the organization's importance to what he optimistically described as Pakistan's continued success. Of course, he was careful to keep the history lesson non-controversial, a light entertainment for his guest as the elevator rose toward the top floor. He didn't mention that the massive expansion of the organization had been funded with dollars that were supposed to have gone to supply the Mujahideen's resistance to the Soviets, or the S-Wing
a loose confederation of largely retired ISI operatives in charge of liaising with terrorist groups. And he certainly didn't touch on the fact that the power of the ISI had grown to such proportions that a former Pakistani president had once referred to it as a state within a state. The elevator doors opened, and Gadai led her through a richly appointed hallway that had been cleared for her arrival. Ahmed Taj's suite was at the far end, and Gadai led her through the outer office. "It's been a pleasure meeting you," he said, before opening the ISI director's door for her. "I hope to see you again soon." Kennedy smiled politely before stepping across the threshold. Ahmed Taj immediately rose from his desk and strode toward her with a hand outstretched.
"It's wonderful, as always, to see you, Irene. I thank you for making the journey. I trust it wasn't too tiring?"
"It was nice to get away from the office, Ahmed. I imagine you're one of the few people who can understand."
"Indeed," he said sympathetically, and then motioned toward a group of couches set up in front of one of three stone fireplaces. The office was an opulent affair, entirely at odds with the modern architecture of the building. At least four times the size of her own, its walls were covered in rich wood paneling. Numerous bookcases were arranged with photos and other memorabilia, but few actual volumes.
"Tea?"
"Yes, thank you." Kennedy examined Taj as he poured. The man was a stark contrast to the imposing surroundings which she knew to be the work of his predecessor. At the Pakistani president's urging, Parliament had chosen the ISI's new director not for his ruthlessness or cunning, but for his spectacular mediocrity. Taj's gift for military supply logistics, as well as his ability to navigate the egos and agendas of his superiors, had allowed him to rise to the rank of Air Force General. When compared to even his own young assistant, though, Taj came up wanting. His suit was of average quality, he stood barely 5'6", and his stomach seemed to expand a little more every time she saw him. He had never been an athlete, and his grades had been good, but far from spectacular. Most notable, though, was the fact that whereas Gadai met her eye and spoke in a clear, confident tone, Taj had a tendency to mumble and look at the floor. At first she'd been surprised when he'd been named, and thought that it was perhaps meant as a tacit apology for the Osama bin Laden fiasco. What she'd come to learn, though, was that Taj possessed the one quality that the country's president needed. He was controllable. Whether this was a good thing or not was, like everything related to Pakistan, a complicated matter. The ISI was heavily factioned. It wasn't unusual for one branch to be hunting a particular terrorist group while another funded it. That incohesiveness weakened the organization and benefited the civilian government, but it also contributed to the dangerous chaos Pakistan was descending into. Mitch Rapp summed up the ISI situation as a simple question of whether organized crime or disorganized crime was preferable. In his words, would she rather deal with a mafia or a bunch of shiv-wielding junkies?
"I'm glad you agreed to come," Taj said as he finished pouring and took a seat across from her. "I think a face-to-face meeting is better to put this matter behind us."
"So do I." She picked up her cup and took a sip, making it clear that she wasn't inclined to offer more.
"In our last meeting you made a number of accusations."
"Accusations seems like a strong word, Ahmed. I would say concerns." His dull eyes fell to the coffee table.
"Concerns, then. I'm afraid they were largely justified."
"Indeed," she said, keeping her expression passive.
"Yes. I've been authorized to tell you everything we've been able to determine about your man, Joseph Rickman."
She didn't respond, letting the silence draw out between them until he felt compelled to start speaking again.
"He did not die in the video released on the internet."
She let the surprise read on her face, despite knowing that Rickman had met his end, like so many before him, at the hands of Mitch Rapp. "I'm sorry. I don't understand."
"He was, in fact, transported to Pakistan, specifically to Akhtar Durrani's private compound."
"The deputy director of your external wing? To what end?"
His death video was a ruse to ensure that both you and I would stop looking for him. He was transported to General Durrani's home and held there to give Akhtar time to extract everything Rickman knew about the CIA's operations.
And you're telling me you had no knowledge of this? Kennedy said, making it a point to allow a bit of skepticism to creep into her voice.
None, Taj said emphatically. It seems likely that Durrani wanted to use this information to inflate his own power and unseat me as director.
Of course, that is how he would see it. In truth, Durrani had been a thug. Not a stupid man, per se, but hardly clever enough to be behind this scheme. No, Rickman had been in charge the entire time. He would have allowed Durrani the illusion of control while he used the man and his organization to carry out his plan of gutting the CIA's worldwide operations.
Can I assume you'll be turning Rickman over to me immediately?
Taj's dark skin took on a pallor.
I'm sorry to inform you that he's dead.
As is Durrani, Kennedy said. The press release I read said a heart attack.
In fact, both appear to have been shot by Durrani's man Wazir Qassar, who gained access to his compound with an unknown accomplice. Of course, we'll turn Rickman's body over to your embassy as soon as we can make arrangements.
Kennedy brushed her dark hair behind her ear and leaned back into the sofa. Taj's story explained his forthrightness. The operation against Durrani was highly professional, and he had been unable to identify Qassar's accomplice. He would have no choice but to consider the possibility that the CIA had been involved and that she already knew about Durrani's plot. Better to confess and place the blame on a dead man than be caught in a lie that could implicate the entire ISI.
Can I also assume that the men who were killed in Switzerland were ISI assets?
Yes, Taj said, looking increasingly miserable. Durrani's men, they were interested in the banker Leo Obrecht, who, as you know, seems to have been deeply involved in what was happening. The one who escaped was Qassar. We are trying to find him, but so far have had no luck.
It was an unlucky streak that would continue. She had Qassar. He'd declined her job offer, opting instead for a new identity, a U.S. passport, and enough money to start a new life. What information did Rickman provide Durrani before their deaths? Was there anything beyond what we saw in the video?
I'm afraid I have no idea. All the computers were missing from Durrani's house. I assume taken by Qassar and his men. An exhaustive search of his home turned up nothing of interest. Currently, we're working on his internet usage, bank accounts, and known associates. Rest assured that we're doing everything possible to dissect Durrani's plan and determine whether he passed sensitive information to any of his people. I'm not aware of any additional revelations since their deaths, and my assumption is that Rickman's knowledge was limited to your network in Afghanistan. My hope is that this incident is behind us.
Kennedy sat quietly on the sofa. Unfortunately, his hopes and her own would be dashed. Rickman's genius and years in the clandestine services had left him with knowledge far beyond his theater of operation. And the situation with Sitting Bull suggested that at least some of that knowledge had made its way into the wrong hands.
I appreciate your forthrightness, Ahmed.
We understand the seriousness of the situation and acknowledge the friendship you've showed our country. We are entirely to blame for this incident, and can only hope you understand that both I and President Chutani are doing everything we can to mitigate the damage.
She decided to ignore what was undoubtedly meant as an apology, instead changing the subject.
And Qayyum?
Lieutenant General Abdul Rauf Qayyum had ordered an attack on Mitch Rapp that had led to the death of one of Rapp's men as well as 21 Afghan police officers.
We're trying to locate him, but it will be difficult. My understanding is that he believes your Mr. Rapp is hunting him, and because of that, he has fled to the mountains.
Taj's information paralleled her own. Rapp had Commander Abdul Siraj Zahir of the Afghan police looking for the man, but Zahir reported that the general had disappeared into the hinterland and abandoned all electronic communication. Of course, Zahir was a sadistic psychopath who had changed sides in the Afghan conflict more times than anyone could count. So who could say for certain? My problem, Ahmed, is that the Afghan police are blaming Mitch for attacking their men without provocation. Can I assume you'll use your network to set the record straight? The rumors and animosity are making it difficult for my people to do their jobs.
Of course. We'll begin spreading that message immediately.
She doubted that was true, but at a minimum, his failure to grant her request would be something she could use against the ISI in their future dealings. I'd like to make something very clear, Kennedy started, but then fell silent when the door to Taj's office opened. When she caught a glimpse of the man in the threshold, she immediately rose to her feet. Taj did the same, but didn't seem to share her surprise.
"I don't think we've had the pleasure,"
President Saad Chutani said, shaking Kennedy's hand and then indicating toward the sofa.
"Please accept my apologies for intruding."
She lowered herself back into the cushions. "No apologies necessary, Mr. President. I'm honored." Chutani was a head taller than his intelligence chief and seemed to dominate the man in every way.
"I don't have much time, but I wanted to personally reaffirm my confidence in Ahmed."
"Thank you, Mr. President."
Chutani slapped him on the back, seemingly unaware that he'd spoken.
"Could you excuse us for a moment? I'd like to speak privately with Director Kennedy."
"Of course, sir."
They both watched Taj retreat across his own office and close the door. When he was gone, Chutani took a seat across from Kennedy and appraised her. The intensity of his stare was both impressive and unsurprising. He'd been one of the country's top generals for years before entering politics. Somewhat unusual for Pakistan, he'd become president through an election and not a coup. Since then, he'd managed to marginalize the country's prime minister and parliament, gathering more and more authority for his office. In many ways, he had become little more than a dictator, but as pro-American a dictator as could be reasonably hoped for in this part of the world. Kennedy just sat quietly. Some of the most powerful people in the world had tried to stare her down, and she found it was best not to react. Politicians were creatures controlled by passion, and it was most effective to quietly absorb that energy without actually giving ground.
"I'd like to extend my personal apologies to you and to ask you to relate that to President Alexander."
"Of course, sir." He smiled.
"I'd heard that you're difficult to ruffle, and it seems those reports are accurate."
"Sir?"
"I'd like an honest assessment, Director Kennedy. How badly has this hurt our relationship?"
"I know that our Secretary of State is going to be visiting Islamabad soon. I think she would be a more appropriate person to ask that question."
"But you're here now, so I'm asking you."
It was a position Kennedy felt uncomfortable in. She wasn't a politician, and had no desire to be one. Having said that, refusing to answer a direct question from the President of Pakistan seemed impolitic. "First bin Laden, now one of your people kidnaps our top operative in Afghanistan and tortures him for information," she started, careful to state only the public story. "It's been a difficult time for U.S.-Pakistan relations. An era that I think we'd all like to bring to a close."
"It has indeed been difficult. But you forgot to mention your CIA agents brazenly killing our citizens, and that your embassy is shielding Pakistani citizens accused of spying by your Joe Rickman. Also, there are the constant drone attacks." "None of this is easy for me. I answer to the people of Pakistan."
"President Alexander has been clear that our drone program could be significantly scaled back if you think it's necessary." The politician's smile lost a bit of its gleam. They both knew that he was using America's drones to destroy fundamentalists targeting his regime and not those threatening the United States. It was another nuance that she'd found Congress impervious to understanding. Insofar as scoring political points went, one dead terrorist was as good as another to them.
You're not a naive woman, Director Kennedy. You understand what I'm dealing with in trying to reinvent Pakistan as a modern country. Taj is very reasonable and more intelligent than you perhaps give him credit for. But many of our enemies aren't reasonable. Indeed, many of the men working at this very organization aren't reasonable. Unfortunately, men like Durrani and your Mitch Rapp are valuable in their ability to understand our terrorist enemies and, if necessary, to match their brutality. With all due respect, Mr. President, Mitch has never betrayed me or his country. Then he's a unique man. The skills he and Durrani possess usually come with ambition. Taj didn't watch Durrani close enough. It's a classic mistake, really, to judge others' rationality based on one's own. I assure you, he won't make it again.
I trust, then, that Durrani's replacement will be easier to work with? Chutani frowned.
Concessions had to be made. The new man is not as volatile as Durrani, but he's still very strong. He has to be able to control certain elements within the ISI, elements that it will take time to eradicate.
I'm certain he was an excellent choice, and I look forward to meeting him, Kennedy said, making sure she sounded sincere.
Cooperation and stability, Director. That is what will be good for both our countries. Pakistan needs economic growth and education. Those are the only things that will break the influence of the radicals. People with good lives are hesitant to jeopardize them. People who have nothing, on the other hand, are often no better than wild animals.
She nodded and took a sip of now lukewarm tea. I'll be happy to deliver your message to President Alexander, sir. I know how much he values your friendship and the friendship of your people.
Chapter 4 Istanbul, Turkey. Vasily Zhutov skirted close to the building next to him, ignoring the dim display window full of electronics. The rain was coming down harder, but instead of pulling the umbrella from his briefcase, he just walked faster. His masters in Moscow had thought he was insane when he'd volunteered to fill an open position in Istanbul. It was technically a demotion, but he needed a break if he was going to stave off the middle-aged heart attack suffered by so many of his colleagues. Everything in Turkey didn't revolve around vodka and heavy food, and his new position didn't rate a car and driver. He'd mapped out this 4-kilometer path home from his office the first week he'd arrived. It wound through an area that closed down by the time he got off and was thus devoid of pedestrians who could slow his pace. In less than a month, he'd lost 2 kilos and cut the time it took to cover the hilly course by almost 2 minutes. He turned left into a cobblestone alleyway and glanced at the numbers counting down on his digital watch. It wasn't a record speed, but considering the weather and descending darkness, it was respectable. More important to his health than the weight loss, though, was the fact that he was 2,000 kilometers from the Kremlin, where career advancement was a universe unto itself. The job became not so much protecting the interests of Mother Russia as it was protecting one's own interests. His days had devolved into a blur of questionable political alliances and elaborate plots to destroy his rivals while they hatched similar plots against him. That was what had driven him into the arms of the Americans. Of course, Russia's leaders would loudly condemn him as a traitor if they found out, but deep down, they knew it was they who had betrayed their country. They, who were turning it into a corrupt basket case, barely kept afloat by natural resources gouged from the land. There was no innovation, no plan for the future, no attempt to meaningfully engage the West. Only the occasional flexing of military muscle to stir the people's nationalism and blind them to the fact that they had no more hope now than they did under the communists. Zhutov was forced to divert around a van moving across the entrance to a square dominated by an empty playground. He looked through the rain at the rusting equipment and once again considered how it could be used to enhance his daily exercise routine. Would a pull-up be achievable before he was recalled to headquarters? His doctor had urged caution, but at 43 it seemed in the realm of possibility. The van began to move, and Yutov adjusted his trajectory to cut across its rear. When he did, the driver slammed on the brakes, fishtailing on the slick cobbles. The back doors were thrown open, and he stumbled to the right, barely avoiding being hit by one. Despite extensive training in his youth, Yutov froze. He found himself unable to resist as a man leapt out of the vehicle and grabbed him by the front of his suit jacket. The Russian was nearly lifted from the ground as he was driven into the vehicle's cramped cargo space. Somewhere in the distance, he heard the wet squeal of tires, but the sound seemed to disappear when he looked into the dark eyes of the man preparing to close the doors from his position on the street. "No!" Zhutov shouted before he could be closed off from the outside world. His heart rate, already elevated from adrenaline and his evening workout, shot up again when he managed to put a name to the face. "Stop! I haven't betrayed you! I swear I haven't!" He tried to fight into a sitting position, but someone behind him grabbed his shoulders and held him down. Zhutov looked up at the disarming grin and neatly trimmed blonde hair of Scott Coleman. "Relax, Vasily, we're the good guys." "Go!" Rapp shouted, slamming the doors. He was sprayed with water as Maslik gunned the van's anemic engine and drifted it onto a winding street leading north. The safe house was less than 3 miles away, and Coleman's team would hole up there for a few days to debrief Zhutov and build him a new identity. A more pressing problem was a similar van barreling down on Rapp from the other side of the square. Behind him there was a narrow walkway between two buildings. It would be an easy getaway since he wasn't aware of a single Russian operative who could even come close to keeping up with him on foot. It would also leave a lot of questions unanswered. Too many, Rapp decided. Kennedy would just have to deal with the fallout. He slipped his Glock 19 from beneath his jacket and sighted over the silencer toward the van now just over 20 yards away. The windshield wipers were running at full speed, giving him a clear view of the two men in the front seat. He aimed at the driver and squeezed off a round. The Winchester Ranger bonded wasn't his normal go-to ammunition, but it was ideal for this scenario. Subsonic to eliminate the crack caused by the round breaking the sound barrier, but with excellent penetration capability. A spider-webbed hole opened directly in front of the driver's face, but the bullet didn't find its mark. It wasn't entirely unexpected. The deflection of even a hard-hitting bullet could be significant. In his career, he'd experienced everything from shots that went straight through to the target to one that veered so violently it had sheared off a side-view mirror. The van swerved as the driver instinctively raised his hands to protect his face from the tiny shards of glass. Rapp fired a second shot at the damage made by the first. The softened glass reduced deflection and a spray of blood erupted when the driver's forehead was torn away. The vehicle slowed as the man's foot went limp, and Rapp moved left, bringing the side door into view. These tended to be three-man operations, and that suggested the last team member was out of view in the cargo section. It was a prediction that was proved right when the door slid open and a bulky man with an unsuppressed Russian 9A91 assault rifle started to leap out. Rapp blew the back of his skull off and watched as he pitched forward into the street. One of his feet got tangled in a seatbelt, and he was dragged along, leaving a broad streak of blood and brain matter on the wet cobblestones. The surviving man in the passenger seat grabbed the wheel and turned the vehicle toward Rapp, desperately trying to get his foot past his dead companion's leg in order to slam the accelerator to the floor. It was a vaguely pathetic sight, and Rapp just stood there as the van rolled to a stop a few feet in front of him. "Get out!" he yelled as the Russian stared at him wide-eyed and raised his hands. He did as ordered, and Rapp indicated toward the corpse hanging halfway out the door. "Put him inside." The dead weight looked significant, but the Russian managed. The square and the windows of the building around them were still empty, but it wouldn't last. One local with a cell phone was all it would take to bring the police down on him. "You're driving," Rapp said, keeping his weapon lined up on the man as he dragged what was left of the original driver into the cargo area. Rapp climbed into the passenger seat and pulled the door closed, pressing the tip of his silencer into the man's ribs. "Go, nice and easy. No need to attract attention." The Russian seemed reluctant to lean back into the blood-soaked headrest and instead hunched over the wheel as he steered the car past an empty playground.
"What's your name?" Rapp said. "Vadim Yanotin. Do you know who I am?"
The man swallowed and nodded.
"Then you understand your situation."
"Yes."
They turned onto a broader avenue and were immediately surrounded by the glare of headlights.
"You have two options, Vadim. The first is that I take you to a safe house with a soundproof basement. Things get ugly, and you tell me everything you know."
"I do not like this plan."
His accent was thick but understandable.
"You're smarter than you look. Good. Option two is for you to answer all my questions completely and truthfully. After that, my boss calls your boss, and they do a little horse trading. You know the drill. We give up a little information and maybe pad a few of your superiors' retirement accounts. A week later, you're sitting in your apartment drinking vodka."
"Yes, I like this very much. This is what should be done."
"Why were you sent to pick Zhutov up?"
"The FSB received an email saying that he was being paid by the Americans."
"Who was it from?"
"Joseph Rickman."
"And you just believed it?"
"There was a great deal of information. The names of his handlers, information he'd passed to the CIA, dates, places. It said that he is the sitting bull that Rickman spoke of on the video."
"When did you get the email?"
5 days ago."
Rapp pulled his gun from the man's ribs and jammed it into his crotch.
"I thought you weren't going to lie to me, Vadim. Option one is now back on the table."
"No, I was informed 5 days ago. I saw the email myself. Our people checked the servers to confirm the date and to try to find where it came from, I swear."
"Pull over to the next side street and park, Vadim. I don't want you to run over anyone when I blow your nuts off."
"I have no reason to lie to you about this. We arrived 4 days ago and began watching Zhutov to see if he would lead us to any of his contacts. We flew in on a commercial airliner and went through passport control. I can give you the names we used."
"Joe Rickman died 2 weeks ago, Vadim. So unless he's figured out a way to stuff his brain back into his skull, you have a serious problem."
"Impossible. Please, check my story. The CIA can do this easily. You will find that I am telling the truth."
Rapp kept the silencer pressed into the man's crotch, but his desire to pull the trigger began to wane. He had a nose for lies, and the overwhelming impression he was getting from Yanotin was that he was very fond of his testicles. The Russian wasn't one of the fanatics Rapp had spent his career dealing with. He wasn't looking to get his fingernails pulled in an effort to please Allah. He was a professional who understood the zero-sum game played by world powers.
"You said your people tried to determine where the email came from. What did they learn?"
"Nothing. It traveled all over the world. There was no way to trace its source."
Rapp let out a long breath and indicated for the man to turn right at the next intersection. Things had just gone from complete crap to insurmountable disaster. Chapter 5. Lahore, Pakistan. The Land Cruiser's front wheels dropped into a muddy ditch, and Ahmed Taj heard the whine of the engine as his driver gunned the vehicle toward the low bank on the other side. Taj didn't bother to look outside. He'd grown up surrounded by such places, and little had changed over the years. Unmaintained, dirt roads still threaded haphazardly through tent cities and mud-brick huts. The clear sky was still obscured by smoke from cooking fires. The only anomaly was the absence of people. Normally, the area would be filled with children not yet bowed by their circumstances and adults trying desperately to find a way to fill their bellies. On this day, his security detail had coordinated with the local Islamic militias to clear his entry and exit routes. The SUV he was in was painted white and emblazoned with the logo of one of the aid agencies active in the area, allowing for a certain amount of anonymity, despite being the only vehicle on the street. He glanced upward through the moon roof and saw nothing. It was an illusion, though. The Americans were ever present, watching with satellites, drones, and co-opted security cameras. Their mastery of technology was their greatest strength, but their utter reliance on it was, ironically, their greatest weakness. Areas like these had been slowly taken over by various radical groups with the help of Akhtar Durrani and his notorious S-Wing. The task of relocating these groups from the rural areas to the cities had been as critical as it was monumental. Here, mixed into the general population, even the most surgical drone strike would generate substantial collateral damage. The Americans were uncomfortable with civilian casualties and absolutely abhorred photographs of the blackened bodies of women and children. It was all part of the bizarre web of lies and hidden agendas created by his country's long relationship with the United States. Many of the politicians in Washington believed that the quagmire in Afghanistan had been caused by the U.S. abandoning the region after the Soviets fled. It was a naive and arrogant view, an example of how the Americans saw the world as revolving entirely around their fleeting experiment with democracy. Afghanistan had simply reverted back to what it had been for 1,000 years, an inevitable and easily predicted outcome. The money originally earmarked for the Mujahideen, though, continued to flow. In the last year alone, the United States had supplied almost $5 billion in aid to Pakistan, most of which had been quietly absorbed by the military and ISI. In fact, the army was now the country's largest holder of commercial real estate, owning condominium complexes, shopping malls, and office buildings throughout the world. Pakistan's generals were some of the wealthiest men in the country. While the situation was hopelessly complicated, its fundamentals were simple. Pakistan's military-industrial complex and intelligence apparatus had become addicted to American dollars. The only real threat to that massive source of funding was the eradication of terrorism in the region. This left the ISI in the twisted but wildly profitable business of publicly fighting the terrorist threat to America while privately supporting it. It was a situation that had to be handled with the utmost care. Enough fires had to be ignited to keep the Americans chasing after them, but no single fire could burn so brightly that it garnered too much attention. Unfortunately, that line had been recently crossed. Durrani had pressed Afghan General Abdul Qayyum to set up an assassination attempt on Mitch Rapp. It had been a largely foolish enterprise, turning entirely on successfully killing a man who had proved countless times to be immune to such actions. Now Rapp was leaving no stone unturned in his search for Qayyum, including pressing into service Abdul Zahir, who was as shrewd as he was loathsome. Arrogance was a trap that had killed countless powerful men, and it was one that Taj had promised himself he would never fall into. Mitch Rapp was not someone to be trifled with. Only a fool would refuse to acknowledge that he usually got what he wanted. And what he wanted was to hunt down and butcher his enemies. Local militia began appearing on the street, dirty men with Kalashnikovs and faces obscured by scarves. They watched his vehicle pass but made no move to block its progress. The Land Cruiser threaded through a narrow gap in a mud wall and stopped on the other side. Taj stepped out, looking down to hide his face from potential surveillance drones. The stone hovel was only a few meters away, and he covered the ground quickly, passing through a door that had been cobbled together from materials scrounged from a landfill. Inside, the heat and stench of excrement condensed into a humid fog. The single room was empty, and he crossed to the back of it, descending a set of rickety stairs to a basement carved from the earth. It was, in fact, one of the many entrances to an elaborate maze of fetid tunnels designed to obscure the movements of the insurgents inhabiting the area. Near the base of the stairs was a lone man, naked, except for a black canvas hood secured around his neck. His hands and feet were wired to the chair he was in, and his head moved with bird-like jerks as he tried to track the movement his ears had picked up. Taj stopped in front of the man, letting his gaze sweep from the stomach resting on thighs thick with hair to a tray arranged with knives, pliers, and a single propane-fueled torch.
Ahmed!
Taj turned toward the figure of General Qayyum as he emerged from a tunnel beneath the stairs.
Abdul, it brings me joy to see you.
They embraced, and when Taj pulled away, he pointed to the naked man in the chair.
You found him. He's a clever little cockroach, Qayyum said. He has many rocks to hide beneath, but his main tool is fear. Fortunately, some of his men are more afraid of me than they are of him.
He pulled the hood off, and Taj looked into the terrified eyes of Abdul Zahir. His hair and beard were shoe-polished black, contrasting the gray streaks of his body hair.
It was the custom of Afghan men to try to look younger than they were in a country where age was often seen as a sign of weakness.
"Are you pleased?" Khayyam asked.
It was hardly the right word. He was angry about Khayyam's attack on Rapp, but it was impossible to blame the man. He was an old and loyal friend who had only been following Akhtar Durrani's orders. The great lengths the ISI went to in order to ensure unquestioning loyalty could at times have drawbacks. Khayyam would have never even considered questioning the orders of the deputy general of ISI's external wing.
"Please,"
Zahir said through chapped, swollen lips, but then seemed to lose his train of thought.
"Please."
"And what would you have me do for you?"
Taj said.
"You are a pig who believes in nothing, who serves neither God nor his people, who allies himself with whoever pays the most."
"It's not true,"
he said, the lack of force in his voice suggesting that even he recognized the absurdity of the denial.
"You were never of any importance, Zahir. I would have been content for you to just die of old age, surrounded by the things your treachery allowed you to acquire. But then you allied yourself with Mitch Rapp.